The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
I voted for Hillary.
I plan on voting for John Kasich. He's the only Republican candidate to me with real-life governing experience.
And all I can say is, I'm feeling the burn.
I vote for Marco Rubio because he's the last sane person in this contest.
Like many others, unfortunately, I have already voted. As soon as I received my absentee ballot, I marked my preference, Jeb Bush, and mailed it.
Bernie is my candidate.
I plan to vote for Hillary Clinton,
and I voted for Kasich.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. It's voting day in Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. You can call it Mega Tuesday or Titanic Tuesday, second only to Super Tuesday in the number of delegates on the table. Now, you know what's at stake. Marco Rubio has to win in Florida or likely drop out. If that happens, there goes another GOP hope for derailing Donald Trump. For the Democrats, Bernie Sanders has shown an ability to pull off upsets, and he'll need some if he wants to start eroding Hillary Clinton's growing delegate lead. Now, one story behind the race is voter turnout. So far, this year's turnout on the Republican side is higher than any year since 1980, and for Democrats since 1992, with the exception of 2008, which saw record high turnout levels for the race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Here to help us figure out what's driving voters to the polls, Crystal High Taylor. She's editor-in-chief and publisher of Politic 365. It's an online magazine focused on politics, policy, and communities of color. Crystal, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm great. Well, there's high turnout on both sides. We just heard record turnout for Republicans and near record turnout for Democrats, except the 2008 Obama year. It's impressive on both sides. But what's driving it?
So I think we're seeing a lot of energy on both sides. On the Republican side, caused a lot by Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, and on the Democratic side, particularly by Senator Sanders. But there's a lot of energy of bringing new people into the fold, into the electorate, who don't typically participate in the process. And I think, you know, sometimes we can say it's a lot borne by anger and resentment and upset and feeling as if there's a failed political establishment, a failed political process. But at the same time, I think that people are coming to the table in a new way and realizing that, hey, if we don't get involved in this process, we're going to continue to see policies. We're going to continue to see politics play out in a way that's disadvantageous to us. So I guess it's time to pick up the mantle and get engaged.
Well, what do we know from the data about high voter turnout in the primary and then turnout figures in the general election? Are they necessarily related?
Well, so primary turnout is always significantly lower than general election turnout, right? Because what happens at the primaries, you're bringing out kind of the core, right? The base of the base, like who really makes up the Republican Party, who really makes up the Democratic Party, and who then is going to take the time out to actually go and vote. So traditionally, you know, we rarely exceed the 20% threshold when it comes to people actually turning out in the primaries versus in the general election, you'll have about 60% of the voting population turn out to elect the final contenders in those elections.
Hillary Clinton was bragging last night on MSNBC when she was asked about turnout that despite Donald Trump's impressive numbers, she has actually gotten 600,000 more votes than he has in this primary season. Is that true? And how do we interpret that in context?
Yeah, so I'm still looking over some of the data that's come out from last night. So I'm not entirely sure if she has gotten that many more votes than Donald Trump. It would be an interesting thing to look into, though, right? Because Democratic turnout overall so far this primary season, though higher than normal, is lower than it is for the Republicans. So Democratic turnout during the primaries is about 11.3%, whereas on the Republican side, it's about 17.1%, I believe. Pew Research Center just did some research on it last week. And I think that what that dynamic says is the Republican base is energized in a way and is turning out in a way that we're just not seeing on the Democratic side. So it'd be really interesting to see kind of side-by-side comparison on where their numbers are.
There is a new voter ID law in North Carolina taking effect as North Carolina goes to the polls in the primaries today. What impact do you expect that might have on voter behavior? What's the impact of new voter ID laws that we've seen in some other states that have voted already?
So far in North Carolina, what we've seen is that the early voting turnout has been primarily older voters, primarily women, primarily more affluent people. And those are characteristically the voters who, frankly, already have IDs in their possession, right? Because if you have your driver's license, if you have a passport, that qualifies as valid ID. So those typical voters probably aren't affected. Where you're going to see the most impact, though, is really on the potential new voters, young voters, right? Millennials are the people who, frankly, especially on Bernie Sanders' side, that is the lifeblood of his campaign. But if they don't have the proper ID, if they're in school, out of state, and they don't have adequate representation that they are who they say they are, that could have a tremendous turnout. On the same token, if you have really elderly voters, right, people who perhaps don't drive, so they don't have driver's licenses, right, they don't know where their birth certificate might be because they're 80-some, 90 years old. Those are the people, sometimes the most vulnerable, who are really going to have a problem with this voter ID law, because if they have not, in the months leading up to this point, been able to obtain the identification that they need just to get the driver's license, the passport, the other certified ID that applies, then they're out of the process, right? And certainly they're not going to be able to have their full voice represented at the polls.
A new round of primary voting today, Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, Illinois, other states too, watching the polls for the impact on turnout, the impact on voter ID laws. Crystal High Taylor, editor-in-chief and publisher of Politic 365. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So even as he faces what could be a successful round of primaries today, Donald Trump's campaign has jarred a lot of this country's institutions. The Republicans now scrambling to defeat Donald Trump, they were unprepared for this phenomenon and waited too long to act. Now, at the same time, a lot of political journalists are wondering if their reluctance to be more critical of Trump's candidacy has actually helped enable it. Look, I'm a guy who very early on refused to talk about Donald Trump at all on this show. I thought that a TV reality hucksterish birther-fueled candidacy was best ignored, like a bad commercial. But Trump's candidacy is very viable now. And now the question, what does it mean to be strictly objective, to weigh one side against the other when the content of a campaign includes incitement to violence, xenophobia, and in some cases, racism? If journalists are strictly objective then, weighing one side with the other, are they serving listeners and readers, or does it only normalize aberrance into our political discourse? Put another way, should journalists take a neutral view of Donald Trump's candidacy, given the ingredients that he's chosen for it? Samuel Friedman is a professor of journalism and journalistic ethics at Columbia Journalism School.
I think in a media landscape that's so oversaturated with opinion already, there's more of a need than ever for the best form of traditional nonpartisan reporting as opposed to commentary. But that doesn't mean being lazy as a reporter, and doesn't mean taking false refuge in on the one hand, on the other hand. But I think the answer, not for commentators and opinion writers or opinion broadcasters, but the answer for the reporters out in the field working for traditional news organizations is to do more reporting, that you don't have to put a label on what Trump says to say this is racism or this is bigotry. You can answer it, first of all, by getting other people to comment on it. You can answer it with the facts. When Trump talks about Mexico sending rapists and criminals, all a reporter has to do is go and find the data, as some have, to show that undocumented immigrants of all kinds are underrepresented rather than overrepresented in America's prison system. That answers it right there. I think as soon as a reporter who's out in the field covering this as a reporter starts taking it upon herself or himself to put labels on what Trump says, you're falling into his game. His game is to say that the media is biased against him and to punch back against it. Why fall into that when really the facts more than amply answer it? And also, if you trust your viewers and listeners and readers, then when someone says, let's beat up a protester, you know, in the good old days, someone would be carried out on a stretcher. For a reasonably intelligent news consumer, that's pretty obviously incitement. I think if you lay it out, how much commentary does it need for that point to come through? The people who would need to have it labeled probably wouldn't agree with the label to begin with.
At the same time, I'll give you an example, Samuel Friedman. I saw a respected colleague on television just the other night get asked about what's behind some of the incitement and some of the violence at Donald Trump rallies. The B-roll over this question was a black person getting punched in the face. His answer to this question was, it's about economic anxiety. This is a euphemism. And surely that doesn't serve viewers for him to say that.
Well, I think that that's just a misreading of history. There's an element of economic anxiety that's part of Trump's base and also a bigger part of Bernie Sanders' base. But you could be historically accurate and say that there's been a tradition of Republican presidential candidates and presidents, with a few notable exceptions, like Gerald Ford and George W. Bush, playing on racial resentment. It goes back to Barry Goldwater, and it runs through Ronald Reagan. It runs through the first President Bush. It runs through Mitt Romney. So it runs through Sarah Palin. It's been a steady theme. And you can say that, and you're merely citing the historical evidence.
While we're here talking about journalism, I want to talk about myself just for a second, because very early on in the Trump phenomenon on this show, I tried to not discuss Donald Trump. I wanted it to be a no-Trump zone. I thought that a marketer and a huckster and a birther and somebody with proto-racism behind his early political activities was best ignored, because like an annoying ad, it would go away. That hasn't happened, and I missed something important. Was I wrong to want to have a no-Trump place early on?
I don't think it was wrong to err against over-covering him. And I don't think it was wrong to treat Trump like that initially. I think it was the right move. But you have to then deal with the fact that he has tapped into this very large voting base, probably a third of the Republican primary electorate as a whole, and is the front runner, and you can't ignore him.
Samuel Friedman is a professor of journalism at Columbia Journalism School. I'm glad you were here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Todd.
Five states head to the polls today. We want to know from you, are you voting? Who gets your vote?
I voted for Hillary. In the past, I have voted for GOP candidates and will do so in the future. But this year, the GOP is a joke, a scary, non-humorous, frightful joke. I do not feel Bernie's plans are attainable with our current electorate and government. Hillary is experienced and the world is crazy. May the odds be in our favor. Esther from Jacksonville, Florida.
It sounds like a swing voter from Jacksonville, Florida. We got this from DeKalb, Illinois. Yes, I voted for Donald Trump. Any candidate that scares the establishment and the mainstream media this much must be onto something. Is there voting in your state today? We want to hear from you. Who gets your vote? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always leave us a comment on Facebook, facebook.com/TheTakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Russian bombers, transport planes, fighter jets are all flying back to Russia from Syria as Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a withdrawal of his main forces from Syria.
I think that the task that was put before the Ministry of Defense and the Armed Forces is largely complete. Therefore, I order the Minister of Defense from tomorrow to begin the withdrawal of the main part of our military from the Syrian Arabic Republic.
So Vladimir Putin's mission accomplished announcement comes amid a new round of peace talks in Geneva between the Syrian government and opposition forces there. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest wasn't exactly sure how to take the news when he learned of it at his daily briefing yesterday.
I haven't seen the reports, so it's hard for me to assess at this point what sort of impact this will have on the talks. So we'll have to see exactly what Russia's intentions are.
For more now on what this all means for the situation in Syria, we turn to Joshua Landis. He's director for the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua Landis, welcome.
Very good to be with you.
Well, we heard a great deal of surprise in Josh Earnest's voice there for nearly everyone involved. Is this Russian for mission accomplished?
Well, it is in a sense. Of course, your reporter is very correct to not take it completely at face value. This is an opening gambit to the Geneva negotiations, peace negotiations that just opened yesterday. And in that sense, I think Putin is saying, I'm here to do business. I'm willing to negotiate with you. He needs America to meet him halfway.
So what advantage then going into those talks, if this is an opening gambit, what advantage does it put Putin at as he engages the United States and the other countries in these talks?
Well, he's letting the Syrian opposition know that they're going to have to come up with something. And people have forgotten the Syrian opposition in these negotiations because they're so divided. There are over 1,000 of them. And they've asked for Assad to step down and that there has to be a transitional government. That's never going to happen. Assad is very strong now with Russian backing. And it's also a shot across Assad's bow because Assad has been completely inflexible so far. He thought a week ago that Russia was going to take him all away to reconquer Syria. Today, it's very clear that that's not going to happen. And there's a third, which is a shot across America's bow. Putin wanted, when he went into Syria, to become a partner with America in chasing down ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and in a sense, bringing order to Syria. But he wanted Assad to be that partner with America. And America turned up their nose at that. And I think he's a little bit miffed in these negotiations. And he's saying, I can go home and take my marbles, and you'll be left holding the bag in Syria.
And on the other hand, the message to Assad, he's clearly stronger. He's clearly made gains. Putin has propped him up. Is there a chance that he interprets this as twisting in the wind a little bit militarily and politically for his opening position as these talks get underway?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, nobody has a fix for Syria. We have entered these negotiations with the same old, with the opposition and the United States saying Assad has to go, with Assad and the Russians saying Assad's here to stay. And that has torpedoed three previous negotiation attempts. I think Russia is saying, we don't want this to turn into a quagmire. We've got to think outside of the box. Let's all come to the table and be a little bit more honest here. Now, of course, we don't know how honest Russia is being in this willingness to withdraw troops, but nobody has an answer to Syria. And that's what we're going to find out is how do you think anew about some peace process?
Oil prices, of course, have tanked, and Russia is an oil economy in many ways. So in an economic crisis, is part of this sort of a Russian thrift savings plan, get the forces back in and save on an expensive intervention?
Well, when it comes to the Middle East, everybody thinks oil. And there have been lots of speculation amongst the oil people saying Russia is showing willingness to compromise with Saudi Arabia because they're trying to come to an agreement on lowering oil output to increase prices, and that would help both their economies. I don't believe that oil and the Syria problem are that connected together. I don't think Saudi Arabia and Russia are ready to negotiate over shares of markets. I don't think they're willing to cut their share of the oil market. I think this is strictly about Syria.
Yes, but at the same time, Vladimir Putin has a domestic economic situation. Russia is an oil economy as well. He needs money, and I wonder if he's not saving significantly in his own domestic sense by pulling forces back.
Well, that could be a motivation. He doesn't want to get caught in a quagmire. On the other hand, we'll have to see how many forces he really takes out. He's not going to let his big investment in Assad's regime and in Syria go down the drains in order to save some bucks at home. This is a major foreign policy undertaking. And I think this is a lot of smoke and mirrors. It could become reality if other groups meet him at the table halfway.
Vladimir Putin surprises the world, certainly surprises the people seated around Geneva peace talks, pulls his forces out of Syria, sends his jets home. Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've been asking you, are you casting a vote today from Deerfield Beach, Florida? I am a disenfranchised independent voter. I'm not allowed to vote.
This is Vanessa from Miami, Florida. I voted early. I chose to vote for Marco Rubio as he's the only one in Florida that has a chance of beating Trump. If it wasn't for that fact, I'd have voted for Kasich, who I feel is the moderate, sane option for the Republican Party. It's just a shame that we can't vote our conscience in this election. It's sad about the fact that we just don't want to have to give over the White House to a narcissist.
We've been hearing from you from all over the states that are voting today, and we want to hear from you. Are you voting? Who are you voting for? There's also a complete list of all the ways you can contribute to the conversation here on The Takeaway. Check out our website and look at the Connect with The Takeaway button over at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years, with services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Roughly one in 68 kids in the United States is diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. Boys are four times more likely than girls to have the condition, and as a result, much of what's known about autism and the criteria for diagnosing the disorder is almost entirely developed from the study of boys. A group of researchers recently launched a major study of girls and women with autism. The fear here is that women and girls are underrepresented in diagnosis because clinicians looking for male-specific traits are more likely to miss or overlook those symptoms in girls who might be higher functioning. So there's a feedback loop. Emily Brooks was diagnosed on the spectrum as an adult. She's a graduate student in disability studies at the City University of New York, and she writes about gender, sex, and autism. She agrees that early diagnosis is important for everyone, but also worries that parsing out differences between boys and girls can perpetuate stereotypes.
There's been a myth that autism only exists in boys, or that it's biologically more common for boys and men to be autistic than girls and women. And some of the larger organizations kind of perpetuate this myth by having things like light it up blue, with blue representing four times more boys than girls being on the spectrum. And I think as a culture, we just kind of got caught in the idea that being autistic is a male thing, when really it's just another way of being human.
So then it seems like there can be this dangerous feedback loop, right? Because if a lot of girls aren't included in the studies, then the clinicians might not recognize the symptoms when they're in girls, or they're not thinking in those terms because they believe that it's a boy thing, essentially. So fewer girls are diagnosed when they should be, and then you're, you know, kind of back where you started.
That's exactly right. I think of this, you know, this one time where somebody told me about this research study for adults on the autism spectrum and asked me if I wanted to participate. And when I looked into it, they said it was only for men. They say that they have fewer women, and so they want it to be statistically significant. And then I get frustrated when I read articles about girls and women with autism, because sometimes the articles make these broad, sweeping generalizations about what female autism should or does look like. Experts will have quotes saying, girls' brains all do this or do that, or girls are all interested in stereotypically girl things, and that's why we're not diagnosing them, because we're thinking about boy things. And it just drives me crazy, because I don't feel like these things are true for everybody.
So clinicians might see some symptoms and they might miss it in a female patient simply because they haven't read about it enough, or maybe it didn't come up in the scientific meeting when everybody was talking about the latest findings.
It might go even farther than that. It might not just be that they haven't read research. It might also be that they've been specifically told that it's more likely for a girl or woman who comes into their office to have something besides autism, because it's become this culturally entrenched idea of it being a quote-unquote male thing.
So Emily Brooks, if you don't mind talking about yourself a little bit, I'm interested in your own experience with this interaction between gender identity and autism diagnosis. What have you experienced yourself with your clinicians or your parents or just getting through the world?
I identify as being queer and non-binary, which to me just means that I don't feel like my gender identity fits. And one problem that I've had is autism services are not always LGBTQ friendly or affirming, and yet LGBTQ community events are not necessarily accommodating to autistic people. So then I end up feeling kind of stuck in the middle, unsure where to go or which one can be my community. What I'm worried about is that because scientists and researchers and medical professionals are trying so hard to figure out what autism looks like in girls and women, that they're going to accidentally end up coming up with a gender stereotyped idea of girl autism versus boy autism by saying girls don't do this, boys do that. And then I worry that it's going to erase everybody who falls in the middle and doesn't fit exactly into the gender binary.
Still, this can be really difficult, I think, for a lot of clinicians, even those that understand what you're saying, because so many of the patients who come through the door to be diagnosed or evaluated are small kids. May not have confronted any of these issues, at least not in an outward way yet. And certainly in many cases, their parents are not prepared for this type of conversation coming from a doctor or from anyone else. They just want a diagnosis and treatment for their girl or their boy. I mean, that's natural in a way.
It has become natural because of the way that we too often see gender as inextricably linked to biological sex. And if people look at autism through a medical lens as something that needs to be fixed and treated, well, that's a problem in and of itself, instead of seeing it as a different way of being and figure out how can you support people whose minds are different with being successful in the world.
Emily Brooks is a graduate student at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's a journalist who writes about gender, sex, and autism. It's been a pleasure having you here, Emily.
Thank you so much.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. You know, if you think back to the fevered press coverage of the Ebola virus, you might think it was the first time that an outbreak has driven ratings and opportunism in the media. But take a trip back nearly 300 years to Boston in 1721 and witness an ambitious newspaper editor named James Franklin who identified opportunity in the politicized outbreak of a disease. It was the speckled monster, smallpox. Of the town's 11,000 residents, over 6,000 cases of smallpox were reported in 1721, 850 deaths. Now, at the heart of that chaos and destruction was a cover-up. Governor Samuel Shute knew that sailors entering the harbor were infected, but similar to what we've seen in Flint, Michigan, the governor was accused of failing to act. Stephen Koss is the author of The Fever of 1721, the epidemic that revolutionized medicine and American politics. Koss argues that some good actually came out of that failure. In health, there was the development of smallpox inoculation. And politically, the episode paved the way for the Revolutionary War.
The way I found out was that I got a fact-a-day calendar for my wife and kids a long time ago, and I was thumbing through it looking for interesting facts. and saw this event. The central event of my book is a smallpox outbreak and inoculation experiment, which became the first use of inoculation in the West. And I'd never heard of it. I also saw from that one little page that it was very controversial, that the doctor who was attempting it had his life threatened, and that Cotton Mather, whom I'd only known from Salem, was the person who got the doctor to try inoculation. So I was hooked, and I did a lot of research and realized, indeed, that it did change the course of medical history, but there was also a big political hullabaloo going on at the same time.
So then you have Cotton Mather, who, as you said, was already known even at the time to people because of the Salem witch trials, which had taken place a couple of decades before. One of the interesting points in your book is that Cotton Mather learned about the potential for inoculation from a slave who said that this was done routinely in West Africa.
That's true. That's true. As it turns out, inoculation, which was new to Western medicine, certainly in Europe and England and in America, had been practiced at least for decades, if not longer, in parts of Africa, and even longer in Turkey and parts of the Middle East and parts of Asia. So the way Mather stumbled upon it himself was he actually had this conversation with his slave, who he named Onesimus. He asked Onesimus why he had this odd scar on his arm. And Onesimus proceeded to tell him that, well, everybody in my village back in Africa has this, that when smallpox came, they would perform this operation on people who had not had it, and they would live. They would not die from smallpox. Mather kept that in his mind, and then several months later, he stumbled upon a second example in a journal, a scholarly journal. And when he saw that second sort of confirmation of Onesimus, he was convinced that it would work.
So Mather kind of joins forces with a local doctor. They decide, hey, let's try inoculation. That's the medicine part of it, and I think we all understand where that goes eventually, the promise of inoculation. But then the politics. There was an opportunist who was part of all of this, somebody who was political, who had a newspaper, who was against inoculation and spotted, I think, what you could call an open political opportunity to make a name for himself.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it was. And that man was James Franklin. And we all know James Franklin's little brother, Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin and James were thrown together by their dad. Neither one of them was very happy about it. But it turned out to be enormously beneficial for both of them. I mean, in Benjamin, James had not only a really good printer, but also, as it turns out, a contributor. And he and Benjamin opened a shop in 1718 and struggled to make a living because there were already a lot of printers. And so James got it in his head that he could create content and that therefore he could create a demand for what he printed. He wanted a newspaper that was literate and that was political and that was a little controversial and that was funny. When the inoculation controversy started over smallpox inoculation, James saw his opportunity. And I say that Benjamin Franklin learned everything he ever needed to know, he learned in 1721. And what I mean by that is, you know, he learned about how to be a printer and how to succeed in business from his brother, who had very innovative methods. But he also learned about medicine. You know, he saw the inoculation controversy up close. He also learned about politics because James Franklin was reprinting an essay series called Cato's Letters, which established a lot of the basic principles that the founding fathers would use many decades later. And of course, Benjamin Franklin was one of them. So this was an enormously important and mutually beneficial relationship.
So there's lots of threads to this that eventually lead to where we all know this is going, which is the American Revolution. But let's bring it forward to the current day, because this interaction between politics and health crises is something that's familiar to us, Stephen Kos. This happens all the time in the context, let's say, of vaccination, inoculation. It's a compromise between liberty and the greater good. And we see this debate playing out today, anti-science, anti-data, but still kind of asserting individual freedom in our American society.
Right. And I think, you know, what's interesting about 1721 is you get a sense for how great the stakes were. I mean, smallpox was the deadliest disease in history. It had killed about, a tenth of all mankind. It's an incredible statistic. There was a desperation to do something about it. And so when inoculation came along, it was very compelling, just as today we're compelled to protect our children. At that point, the pressure went almost in the opposite direction. You were pressured not to get inoculated versus maybe today when the pressure is more on getting vaccinations. But the same basic paradigm existed.
So what does this episode teach us about when health crises get politicized? I mean, think back to maybe how you observed the reaction to the Ebola crisis. We go through this periodically still.
Yes, we do. It's a tension between wanting to be safe and not having hysteria. And in fact, that was a big problem in 1721. One of the reasons the smallpox epidemic burgeoned, was allowed to grow, was that the government actually tried to repress it, which is also a problem these days. You know, we hear about maybe in Brazil with Zika, and some people would say in Flint, even with the water crisis there, that the government, for economic reasons and or political reasons, wants to hope that everything will just be okay. And what happened in Boston was exactly that. The government had warning that smallpox was coming. It could have acted. It didn't act for a variety of reasons, mostly economic and political, and the result was catastrophic.
That also made fertile ground for the type of incendiary politics that James Franklin and his little brother Benjamin capitalized on.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the smallpox epidemic became a leverage point for the bigger political battle that was going on in Boston at this very time between the royal governor and the Massachusetts House of Representatives. The governor thought he was losing power. He didn't want to lose power because that would mean he'd be recalled by England. His way of doing it was to basically take the Massachusetts House and hold them hostage in an area rife with smallpox, trying to get them to capitulate. And it failed.
Stephen Koss is the author of The Fever of 1721, the epidemic that revolutionized medicine and American politics. Thanks, Stephen.
You're welcome.
And we've been hearing from you on this primary day from North Carolina, Missouri, Illinois, Florida, and Ohio, all voting in the presidential primaries.
My name is Seth. I'm calling from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm a college student who was originally hoping to cross party lines and vote for John Kasich, but the GOP presidential race has just completely alienated me.
My name's Matt, and I'm calling from Canton, Ohio. And today I intend to vote in the primary on the Republican ticket, even though I'm a registered Democrat, so I can vote for John Kasich, not because I like him, but because I don't want Trump to win.
You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.